Major Cochrane, reel 14. Now, the next thing then is the attack. You'd identified these two Italian machine gun posts, and you were making an attack on one of them. What do you remember? What happened? How did you go about it?
Well, the terrain was helpful in a way, because these huge cottage-sized boulders were a damn nuisance. On the other hand, you could get round them, and if you went to the flank of them a bit, there was a chance of climbing up. So all the sort of stuff at Sandhurst came into use here, because this was the first time, really, one did a fire and movement thing. So I told one section to keep firing pot shots, occasional shots, at the distant machine gun post, just to let them know that they couldn't stick their heads up too easily. And the other section, I told what I was going to do. I was going to climb up onto the rock, which was in fact above the machine gun post that was going to be our first objective. I could get there, I knew, without being bothered much. But I wanted them to go on giving covering fire on that particular, and very good Corporal Brown. And I said, what we want is not a whole mass of fire at once, but I want steady fire kept on, so that they decide it's not comfortable to keep popping their heads up. And I don't want them to know what's going on upstairs. So I climbed up, went round the side, which was easy enough to do this more or less undercover. I think the other machine gun post could see me, but there's nothing much they could do about it. Then I got round and onto the top of this huge rock, at the foot of which was the machine gun post, and I had some grenades. I mean, the whole object of this was to do it with grenades, and I had a pouch of Mills bombs. The only difficulty was that the rock on top of which I was, at the foot of which the enemy were, bulged out a bit, so I couldn't just drop them. And the first one sort of bounced off the bulge and exploded well beyond the covering, obviously alarmed them, because they knew there was something happening above. I think I had four altogether, and because they weighed a lot, and there's about as many as you could possibly carry up that hill. So I let the others roll rather slowly after I pulled the pin down the rock face, and they did, in fact, instead of bouncing off the bulge, they rolled over the bulge and fell down. And I told Brown that as soon as you saw the grenades, you were to make a rush for the section post. But in fact, the grenades, they weren't all killed or anything, but certainly the gun was out of action, and they were not anxious to carry on the fight. So that was that one. And then the second one was not quite so easy, because there was no convenient rock to get at them from above or behind. So one had to just do the usual fire and movement thing. One section firing, another section moving. But it was, the ground was too, you couldn't sort of do it by, the ideal, of course, is to do it in stages. One shoots, one section shoots, the other moves, and then you change roles. But that wasn't possible. So Corporal Brown and his section, they just had to come with me for the attack on the second post. But by this, my other section had seen what we'd done about this one, and without any orders being needed, they knew that they now had to stop taking odd pot shots and keep concentrated fire going. from the Bren and the seven or eight rifles all the time. And the machine gunner, I mean, he kept going on at us. And this is one of those occasions when there's no question of hands up and surrender until we were actually on top of them and amongst them. And by this time, I say I was so, had been so frightened by this machine gunner and was so, therefore, in such a furious rage that I had shot him with my pistol, and I think I shot another chap in there. And by this time, the rest of the section were in there too. So I think we had two prisoners, and we mopped up the rest.
How did you feel about that sort of close-range killing? I mean, was it, did it bother you at the time or later?
You don't feel anything, really, except it's him or me. And I think there's some sort of basic gut feeling. God damn it, I've got to make it him, not me. And it's only afterwards you think about it. At the time, I don't think there's any conscious thought, really.
Now, you got this post, what happened then?
Well, those were the only two enemy posts on this ridge. But by this time, the sun was starting to sink. The rest of the company had come up. By the way, I think I'm wrong. I think at some point Alan George had acute appendicitis. I'm not sure if he was with the company at that stage. Anyhow, let that be. I think
you've got him in your book as being there.
Yes. The next thing was, there we were. There seemed to be no more enemy on this really very large ridge. It was it was big enough to hold an entire brigade when we were launching an attack from it. So, I mean, a company of, 50, 60 men was, I mean, just like grinding a bit of pepper onto a huge dish. But we didn't hear, here was a railway line. And the railway line led straight into a tunnel. And I wouldn't send anyone up that tunnel, because I thought if there are any enemy around, it might have, that tunnel is an obvious place, and the first man that steps out is dead. To what avail? We'll get up on top of the tunnel and see what we see. And we crawled forward to where the tunnel emerged from this spur of the hillside and could see nothing. But it still struck me as iffy. Before then, by the way, before the sun had completely set, we did have the company signaller had his helio with him, and we could heliograph back to Battalion HQ that with some casualties we had got a position on top of Cameron Ridge, which was a very large, I've forgotten how I put it now, and I got it across that it was too big a feature for one company to try and hold against counterattack.
Now, you were overlooked, weren't you?
Yes, because this ring of hills was a great deal higher, of course, than we were, another sort of couple of thousand feet.
And that was Mount Sanchil?
Yes. There was two of one way. Sanchil was on the maps. That was the tallest, though. And there was a subsidiary sort of needle-pointed thing, which we always called Briggs Peak. And there was another one further round to the left flank.
But yours were Sanchil and Briggs Peak.
Yes, they were ahead of us. And then from above the tunnel, couldn't see much because we were up on a bit of a hill, so I got a bit more sun, but the gorge through which the road ran was by now completely dark. You couldn't see a damn thing. So we sat tight on the I had a section on top of the tunnel, and I had Company HQ our side of the tunnel, and another section sort of out on the left. And we had to keep our ears open, because I thought this might be the time if there were troops around, enemy troops around, for a counterattack. And they proved themselves, so far, pretty formidable people to be up against. And then, during the night, there was suddenly a hell of a noise inside. No, the first thing was, sentry said to me, "I think I can hear voices there inside the tunnel." And I came up and went in the tunnel a few yards, and I could hear something. So I told the Bren gunner to let rip. And I must say it was the most satisfactory noise inside the tunnel to fire off a whole magazine from the Bren. Then the noise stopped, and then this was succeeded shortly afterwards by a gigantic crash. A huge cloud of dust came puffing out of the mouth of the tunnel. And we found out later that what the Italians had done with great skill was they'd got men into the tunnel. They had in some way blocked the line, and then the outside the tunnel the line still climbed up slightly, and they loaded a wagon full of rock, or perhaps they had it ready for all I know, and just let it go, and it slid down the track into the tunnel till it hit the obstruction, thus successfully blocking it. There had, by the way, been a sort of counterattack on the section on top of the tunnel, so I felt glad I sent nobody forward. It was a very noisy counterattack, and I realized much later, well, the following day, that what an ass I'd been, that this noisy counterattack was to conceal the preparations for sending this truck into the tunnel.
The next morning, you were still up on the ridge.
Yeah, we could now see, we could see even more clearly how we were overlooked. Admittedly, a fairly long range, out of rifle range, from the tops of Sanchelica, but well inside mortar and field gun range. The Italians had a very good, I think the same thing the Indian Army had at the Northwest Frontier, screw guns. Guns, little light field guns, you carry up in pieces on muleback, and then you screwed them all together. And they used these with great success, rather in the same way that you could use mortars in hilly country, in a way that field artillery can't be used. But I still could see, in this bright, bright, very clear dawn light, that down below us, you could see this huge landslide where they'd blown up half a mountain onto the road, and troops still moving around in front of it and over it. Obviously, I imagine they were laying mines or putting up wire. And so that's where, in fact, I told one of the section Bren gunners, I'll have a go with a gun. And I put a 1,000 yards on the site, and I dropped a chap. I trust I didn't kill him, because he wasn't doing me any harm. But I was rather pleased with this display of musketry on my part. Dropping shot, too. And in mountain air, the range is very confusing. Well, that, if you like, was a preliminary to something which became eventually a two-division battle, assaulting the mountains on both sides of this gorge. And the Italians defeated us heavily in a succession of attacks that we made, which were unsuccessful. They defeated the attacks. One of the problems, like all the attacks, was, as I said earlier, in mountain warfare, the trouble of getting enough people to your destination, because you've lost a lot on the way up, mortars, hand grenades, and so on. And secondly, if you did get people up on the top, they really weren't, they hadn't enough water, grub, ammunition in particular, to hold the position against a resolute enemy counterattack. and the Italian army certainly were resolute, and they launched their counterattacks with great vim.
Now, what happened to you? What were you doing during that? Because you weren't in one of those. This is other units attacking.
Yes,
wasn't it? Largely,
we didn't at that time attack. The rest of the battalion came up. It was organised with three companies up, stretched across this ridge, which then became called Cameron Ridge. And one company, or two companies forward. One was, if you like, a little bit back down the hill, and the fourth company, taking it all in turns, had the miserable job of being the carrying company. And that meant, of course, humping up water, rations, tea, ammunition, everything that was needed. And from the forward companies, you couldn't get casualties away in daytime. So it also meant bringing the wounded down the hill. The dead, of course, we had to try and bury them. There wasn't much earth, so they were sort of rather badly buried. But
who would stick into the carrying company? Did your units, your company, C Company, take a turn on that?
Oh yes, everybody did, and it really was a miserable job. Sweat and effort. It really was far worse than being in a battle, I think, but absolutely essential. Eventually, things got slightly better because they took the wheels off a 1,500-weight truck and put on something. Well, they certainly took the tires off, and found it fitted the gauge of the one-track railway line. So this was used as an engine, and so all the stores could be brought up at least the first 1,000 feet from the valley floor, but then of course had to be humped up the rest of the way.
Now, what were your positions like on the ridge?
Sangers, again. You tried to keep, if you were in forward company, you had...
With forward company, would that be on the forward slope?
No, the rear slope. The forward slope, you had to have sentry posts, and the sentry posts had to be, again, sangers. And the only sensible thing to do was to build lots of them, so that the enemy, if there's just one, it was pretty obvious that's where the lookout would be. So you dotted them round. You kept most of the people on the reverse slope. So you were, in fact, you were free of sort of sniper fire, but of course you weren't free from unaimed but pretty accurate mortar and these light field guns fire. So you had steady casualties wherever you were. When you were on the rear slope, you could get around a bit. You were still in view from the tops. So if they had a signal system, they could signal down to their troops a bit lower down, or to their gunners or mortar batteries, where there was movement and where men were.
And what do you remember of your time on Cameron Ridge?
Well, it got worse and worse because as I say, we did our utmost to bury, in a sort of way, our people who had been killed, but. We did have casualties forward. There was patrolling by us and by the Italians, wiring parties, because what a thing to hump up barbed wire, rolls of barbed wire, but we did get barbed wire up. And iron metal stanchion things to try and hold the wire up. We didn't, as I recollect, have the kind of concertina wire which we used to have, which you just pulled out without the need really for something to hold the wire up. So there were, and when later there were counterattacks by the Italians, abortive attacks by our side, there were always plenty of corpses in the dip between Cameron Ridge and the beginning of the upslope, the steep hillside up to Sanchel and Briggs Peak. And these, of course, couldn't be buried. So the stink was awful. They added to odd. Then we eventually got mules. Some mules, of course, got hit in shell fire. We reckon we were pretty good, even in those conditions, about having what you laughably might call latrines.
How did you manage? I mean, what did you do?
Well, you just sort of scraped a hole and told everybody that's your that hole is for you lot and that other hole is for you lot, and you'll fill it in when it's dark or tomorrow, and you'll scratch another one. But we were very put out when, I suppose it would have been happened anyhow, but at one stage we were relieved, the whole regiment, the whole brigade, I think, in fact, came off the hill and had a week about 2 miles back, out of range of the enemy artillery, clean up and so forth. We were replaced on our position by the Royal Scot, by the Royal Fusiliers, and went back up the hill. We were very shirty about the fact they'd been shitting all over the place, and the stink and filth were even worse than they had been before. That probably was inevitable.
Was there a problem with flies or dysentery?
There were. We did have a lot of dysentery casualties. That really broke out. And it was crippling dysentery. I mean, it wasn't just a touch of the squitters or jippy tummy. Quite a lot of soldiers were, apart from the people who'd been wounded, people had to be evacuated with dysentery. Usually, I mean, the battle went on so long, quite a lot of them got back to us after 2 weeks, 3 weeks back in a hospital somewhere.
Did you get dysentery, or were you lucky?
No, I was very lucky.
What about flies? Were they a mess? They wasn't too high.
Flies were hideous. And the awful thing was, of course, we all knew only too vividly what the flies had been crawling over before they were crawling over our grub. And I imagine this is why the dysentery was so bad. There was nothing you could do to keep the smell out of your nostrils except try and smoke if you could. No cigarettes, had run out of tobacco. Pipe tobacco would be difficult to find.
Is that what you smoked, a pipe then? I know you do now.
Yes, I did then. I also smoked cigarettes. But there weren't any cigarettes, of course. And so one fell back on used dried tea leaves, old tea leaves. And the only paper we had, well, loo paper, but we did have, for some reason, masses and masses of signal form. So very coarse paper, but one could A, use it as loo paper, B, roll up some dried tea leaves and smoke it, and it tasted absolutely abominable, but at least for a few moments it wasn't a stink of everything else.
What food did you get up there?
Nothing much. I mean, the only thing that could be brought up, again, the contents with char, you could get, they got up, they had to get up, you lived on it. The sandbag with tea and sugar in
so
it.
So you brewed your own when you were up?
You brewed your own. Because there's no question of a company, you couldn't operate a company cookhouse. You couldn't lug food up, hot stew or something, that was impossible.
So what did you get?
So again, it was bully beef. Because that was the easiest thing to hump up the hill, transport up the hill.
Anything else?
I can't think of anything else we had there except bully beef.
Bread or biscuits, or was it just bully beef?
I think we sometimes got some biscuits, hard biscuits. But I can remember nothing else except bully beef.
Did you go off it, or did you just grit your
teeth? Well, I think one of them wasn't very keen on it, not for the bully beef. But just for these, whatever you did, you were going like this, and you still get these bloody
flapping with your hand.
Sorry, you still get the flies and the bully beef round your mouth. And of course, again, like the desert, every time you scraped your knee on a rock, which is pretty often, you're always getting flies on that. Again, we'd get up, sometimes I brought up rolls of bandages from the MO to try and...
So desert sores were, again, a problem of that?
Well, they somehow wasn't the same thing as the desert sores. It was really... I think not the same thing. It seemed to be more like when you opened your skin up with a cut on something or other. As I say, sharp rocks, you've really got plenty of chips in your knees and legs. This did seem to go rotten, you know, saturate.
But in a different way? They didn't turn into sort of boil-like things?
No.
Now, what about water?
Well, that, of course, you had to be... that was one of the most difficult things. It came up in tin cans. They weren't even... Well, they were tin. They weren't the sort of metal jerry can that we didn't imitate the British Army until we found out how useful the German ones were. These were flimsy metal containers, which were everything was carried in, and so flimsy that if you dropped them or hit them against a projecting rock, you probably punched a hole in them. So the carrying party had to be very careful about getting these tins of water up. And we had enough always to replenish the water bottles. But you couldn't, and enough to make to brew up some char.
Now I've just noticed, by the way, that we ought to read the date. It seems that February the 6th you were there early on, so it looks like it was late January, early February.
Yes, I think it must have been.
So just to correct that, but the other point is there's a story of, you were getting casualties, and there's a story about a Private Roy being badly wounded and asking for you to finish him off. Do you mind telling that story? Because it's quite good in the book. What sort of casualties were you getting? Was this from the mortar fire?
In his case, it was either a mortar bomb or a shell. And he'd been hit by the fragments. And he'd been hit in the face or the head, and also badly wounded in the belly. He was... this is when we were on top over the tunnel. This was a daylight, broad daylight. And I mean, as always, someone's wounded to start with. You don't feel any pain. I mean, it's a shock. But you're numbed from it. It's after an hour or so that you realize exactly how painful whatever the wound may be is. And after this, any course in daylight, we could not, because where we were under observation. You couldn't get casualties out until it was dark. The pain really was bad for him. And obviously, the first thing you do is go and sort of see somebody who's been hit, what's up, where you've been hit, where's your emergency first aid thing. In his case, I mean, so badly hit, the sort of pocket thing you one carried, half a dozen of them would have been no use. And he said, you know, I'm a goner, sir, I'm finished, and I can't bear going on like this. And for God's sake, you know, finish me off now. And I'm sure you've got your pistol on you. Just, you know, one pull on the trigger with that, and I'll be your deeply in your debt. And I honestly, at the moment, was tempted to take him at his word, because he did seem to me to be so seriously wounded, and not just his head, but this thing in his belly, that the chances of his surviving till it was dark, and then being carried down the hill, and then getting to the aid post, were almost nil. But luckily, I thought, no, I can't do that. I mean, you know, this is. So I said, no, I can't do that. I won't do it. And he cursed me, really cursed me. And I said, I still won't do it. And then, when was it? 6 months, a year later, I bumped into him in a queue in a cinema at a hospital in Durban.